Mr. Greenhouse, reel 5. You were just saying they attacked at the strongest point.
That's right. The point was that the counterattack didn't materialise. There was an attempt taken at a counterattack, but it never materialised, and we still settled down. So about 3 days after this, I'm going down to the cookouts to get something for, get some food, because I'm carrying rations up to the thing. When I ran into Pete Jensen, and Pete was commander of the base in Boyata de Tacunha. He was receiving all the things that came in, rather than keeping people away from HQ, which was 50th Brigade headquarters. He was there to direct whatever came in, either the mail, parcels, ammunition, anything, in the right direction. And the other thing was to make sure that unauthorised visitors didn't come into HQ. Boyata de Tacunha was a first-rise village, and Pete said to me, I need you, will you come and join me and act as my assistant down in Boyata? He said, because I've got to be away a lot, and there's always got to be somebody there. He said, allowed me to get away and do what I've got to do, and have somebody there in charge while I'm away. So I said, well, it's up to you. Well, that's all right, I'll just tell them. I mean, this was the way in which things were, you see. He just told them that he made me deputy commander of the base, and I went down with him. And we had a house just off the main square. And in this house, we had our own, because we had visitors, we had our own cook and sort of hospitality room. In addition to that, there were two other people who were, one of was French speaking, the other one was sort of middle European speaking, because we had in the 15th Brigade was the Dombrovskis, which was a middle European speaking. There was still a French battalion there as well, you see. And we also had a couple of dispatch riders who were stationed down there, so that if they had to take messages into Madrid, they just had little French motorcycles. And the main road into Madrid was still open, although it was under fire, the main Arganda road by the Arganda Bridge. They could make this road, but it was under fire from both sides of, and it was only a matter of a few hundred yards it was under fire, and therefore it was always worthwhile, especially early morning or just before dark, to take a chance and do this run. I did it once or twice on the back of the motorcycle, And here, my job was to simply to sort of be there when Pete wasn't there. Now, Pete was absent quite a lot, and so consequently, he had a little truck which he used to go out in, and so consequently, I was very often responsible for receiving visitors. First visitors I received was Ernest Hemingway, with his camera crew and his three foremen which he had, and we had to make sure that they didn't get up to the top without the 50th Brigade HQ or the American battalions being ready to receive them. They didn't just want him trampling over everything, sort of thing. So we had to keep him happy.
Was that easy?
Oh, it wasn't bad, after all, he was quite amenable to the fact that, you can't just go trampling up to the front line and with cameras and everything. In any case, it was dangerous up there, because we were still getting shelled, the shells were still dropping all the way around us. In the area between the front line and Boyata was always being shelled, you see. In fact, this was what Pete was actually doing. Anyway, I arranged.
What kind of impression did Hemingway make?
An rather brash as far as I was concerned, you know. I mean, after all, don't forget I was starry-eyed, and therefore this was a big man. I had read Hemingway. And so consequently, I was quite starry-eyed at the fact that he was this man who was a world-famous author coming to see us, you know. Previous to that, we'd had Holly Pollitt, we'd had Edward Heath and Ellen Wilkinson had come, but they had just come and gone, you know, whereas Hemingway stayed 2 or 3 days. Afterwards, I learned that the Americans wanted to, didn't want him to come up there until they were ready for him. You know what I mean? That there was a bit of a problem. And so we had to just keep him happy, showing him around this place and that place. And I took him along to the place where 2 fascists had arrived in a car and had gone to the Ayun Tamiento, which is the town hall sort of place, and to the guard who was standing outside, Arriba España, you know. And the guard didn't know what to do, you know, for a minute. They actually put his rifle up and realised they were fascist officers and they were arrested. They didn't know that Morata hadn't fallen, or else they'd mistaken Morata for something else, you know. Because, as I say, there were a number of the roads which were open, although they were running in between the two, you see.
But what was this problem that prevented the Americans receiving Hemingway?
I don't know. I think there was some... I never got the full story. It was only later I heard, you know, because for the time I was attached to the Americans later on, that I heard that they just wanted certain things to be settled. Don't forget that the Americans had been in this abortive counterattack. And there may have been some mutinous ideas coming from the men, because they just advanced 10, 15 yards and then pinned down. And quite a number have been killed for no reason whatsoever as far as they were concerned, you know. What happened, they didn't know. I mean, when you're in that position, you don't know what's happened, you know. And same as Mick Brown, you know, he really thought that everybody was a load of idiots and they're even suggesting being an army and so on, you see. So the same thing could have happened with the Americans, but it did take 2 or 3 days before he managed to get up to see the Americans. I mean, they used to come down and see him and chat and talk and so on, but he never got to the men at that point, you know, for those 2 or 3 days.
But you felt disillusioned with Hemingway, did you?
I don't know. I mean, it was, as far as I was concerned, I mean, it was... I didn't have very much contact with him, other than, I've received this message, will you go so-and-so, and so-and-so will be coming down to meet you, and so on, you see.
Who were these women with him?
I don't know who they were. Was there a Martha Leghorn?
Gellhorn.
Yes. I think she was one of them. There was a time when we decided that one thing we could do was to give them a dinner party. And we never had, you know, very much food. We were living almost on chickpeas, as it were, you see. But we had this cook, and I asked this cook if he could really dish up something. There might be, there was a... the commander, the 2 commanders from the American battalion, you know, the political commander and the military commander, Steve Nelson was one, I forget who the name of the other one was, and there were 1 or 2 others, and then there was Hemingway and his ladies, and then there was Pete Janssen, and there was Klaus and Louis Chilfridge, who were the 15th Brigade commanders. And afterwards, I said to the cook, you know, where the hell did you find all that food from? Ah, he says, there's always ways of finding things. And then, whether it was a joke or not, he said, have you seen the cat recently? You know, but I'm quite sure, you know, that this was just a way of telling me to keep my mouth shut. And the next important visitor we had was Professor Haldane, J.B.S. Haldane. And he was particularly interested in the effects of bombing and so on. And in this house, I had a sort of camp bed in the room next to the office. And for Professor Haldane, we put up another camp bed in the office itself. No, that's right. I slept under the table in the office. Just put, you know, put a palliasse down and I slept. So that he had my bed. Now, Pete also had a bed in there. And in the middle of the night, there's this, you know, Haldane was a huge man. Almost filled the door, you see. And he's picking at me, you see. Yes, yes, yes. What are those things in there, he said. I said, what things? He said, those things against the wall. Oh, I said, those are Pete's shells. I said, when the enemy sends over a Dutch shell, Pete goes out there and he collects it. And he brings it back here. And one day he's going to open it up because he firmly believes that there's a message of solidarity, that these shells have been sabotaged. What? You start raving mad. That's enough explosive in there to blow the town to pieces. You madness, you absolute madness. And off he went. We never saw him again. So.
You mean he ran away?
No, no, he did.
He ran away?
He disappeared. I never saw him again. He just went out to Barato and that was that, you know. Anyway, the next day, along came a lot of engineer men, you know, and they loaded all these shells into a truck and they took them all away and they sort of blew them up outside of the field. As I say, there was always something to do every day, like sort of incidents like this. Harry Pollock came, and this was time had passed, you know, they were into March, and there'd been no activity, and there was the sort of feeling, you know, that nothing to do here except catch the lice and play football whenever we could and we stand guard when we did and so on. So there was beginning to get boredom. And so it was decided that the battalion should come out of the mine in two batches and go to a local hall and Harry Pollock would address them. And I always remember Pollock's theme about when you're in the woods, you can't see the trees. The extent of the wood is beyond you. You can just see one tree, you can see another tree, you can see another tree, but you can't see the woods. In other words, he said, you know, you are up there, but you don't realise how important your position is, being there. If you weren't there, then the whole wall would collapse because Franco would enter Madrid. And the moment he enters Madrid, the war is over. Because the Western powers will agree that he is the supreme commander and the ruler of Spain. They promised him that if he enters Madrid. And so they all marched around the town, cheering him shoulder high, and then went back, and then the next lot came, and he told the same story again, you see. But, you know, the euphoria only lasted a very short time, back again. And then, I think it must have been April, May, March. The date is easy to verify. I haven't verified it myself. But the 15th Brigade was pulled out of the line and sent to Alcalá de Henares for a long to leave. Everybody thought they were leaving for good, you see. They were going to somewhere else, and we went to Alcalá de Henares. So I changed my job then. I became in charge of the advance party in Alcalade in Aria. So I had to take the cooks and everybody else up there to prepare for the battalion arriving at Alcalade in Aria. And while I was there, I did a little bit of swapping with the local population and got some chickens and in exchange for the rice and for the chickpeas that we had. And so when the lads arrived, they had chicken soup for supper that night. Sports were laid on and everything, you know. But 5 days later, we were all back in Parama. And this was the time when the famous Parama song was written. And you know, the original, it was there that we made all, gave up our manhood and most of our old age as well. Not the words they use now, but this was a satiric thing of, you know, we've been here far too long. They say we are leaving tomorrow, but tomorrow in Spain is mañana, and mañana in Spain never comes, you know. And all that sort of thing. But,
so when did
from Alcalade and Aries, Pete Jansen never came back. In fact, I didn't see him in Alcalade and Aries because I was still acting as the sort of in charge of this advance party, and I lost touch of Pete. So that when we went back to Arana, there's a completely new setup. In the base, it's an American base, so I am out of a job once more. But in the yard where the headquarters was, there was a truck, tilt-covered truck, and this was an office with a couple of gazetteers and some typewriters, and there was Vic Schammer, also from Manchester, and a Frenchman, and they used to write a newspaper, cycle style, 2 or 3 pages with the war news on and any other news that they could get. And when they took the coffee up in the morning, there was this newspaper, which was supposed to be a morale booster. And Vic Schammer didn't like being away from the lads. So as I could type, only one finger, I'd also used a duplicator because when I was in the YCL, I used to give my Saturday mornings in the office at King Street. And so I became the editor of this newspaper. And we used to get whatever information we could, roughly translating the newspaper which would come, which always had the war communique in, translating the headlines and so on, translating that, finding out from the lads what the latest joke was and what the latest bit of information was and so on. And so we produced our fight. And so that became my new job. Vic went back to the, you know, he still came down every so often, you know, and was still part and parcel of it. Now, we were now under the command of the political commissar. This was George Aitken, the father of Pierre Aitken, the political editor of Guardian. And George was the political commissar of the 15th Brigade.
Was he a member of the CPGB?
Oh, he was an original member trained in Moscow. And I liked George. He had been one who, when the battalion broke on the third day of the Harama battle, he and Frank Ryan and Jock Cunningham had actually persuaded them to go back and take up their positions in the night. And It was one of those fortuitous occasions when the fascists were absolutely dead beat as well as we were. And therefore, if they had known that there was nothing to do, they could have marched into Marata. But when they met this scattered rifle fire, they'd had enough anyway. They'd already had terrific losses. And so that's how Hiroma became a stalemate. Because both sides had actually fought to a standstill. And so then for the next few months, until we were pulled out and went into the Battle of Mineta, I was on this in this truck, and what we used to do, we would sort of sleep during the day, gather the information, late afternoon sort of thing, and then just before it went dark, the three of us, or two of us, whoever was there, would arm ourselves with towels and stand at the front end of the truck, lift the tilt sheet open at the back, and then bang the flies out. By the time we got to the end, it was a black cloud flies. And we kept on batting until the last one had gone, and then we dropped the tilt sheet quickly. If we didn't do that, there would have been so many flies dropping onto the typewriters that we couldn't have done any work. So we had to do this to get rid of, you know, big flies. And that was a routine that we did every night. And then we just had a sort of two-a-night thing and typed away, made our stencils, put them on the hand-driven Gestetner and turned the handle and got some money out. And then with the coffee and rolls or whatever it was that we could take up the next morning, we took the paper up to the lads in the trenches. And from time to time, of course, we got messages like from visitors that we incorporated in the paper. George Aitken, when he came back, he brought a lot of these papers. In fact, he brought one example of every one of them. But after he died, George promised me that he would hand them over to me when he died. After he died, his son wouldn't even answer my letters, so I presume he's either destroyed them or he's sitting on them. Then we pulled out of Verona and prepared for the Battle of Brunetti. Now, one of the items which we had been plugging, because we were taking it from the newspapers, was the fact that the Republican forces were moving out of the era of guerrilla militia becoming an army. And we were to be part of the Fifth Army. And this was a big political issue in Spain. And in order to be an army, all the free and easy atmosphere which had been the usual, where we called George Nathan George, you know, and he all had to go. There were to be insignia of rank and so on, and all this was to happen. Now, when we were in Hiroma for meals, there would be a long table in the sort of yard of this big house, or in the garden of this house, and everybody used to go there and help themselves from the dishes on the side and sit down and eat it. So there were generals and there were drivers all sitting at the same long table. And when we moved out of Hiroma, I can't tell you where we went, but we went into the headquarters, was a big farmhouse, a very big farmhouse. I know I slept in the attic, which was covered with apples, where the apples were ripening. But they still started this long table, and everybody coming in. And one day, General Gal wanted to have a talk with some of the officers, and he found out that there was a driver sitting in between him and the... And so he blew his top, you know. this is not good enough, we've got to look at nobody other than officers above the rank of captain shall eat at my table. Everybody else will have different tables. There'll be junior officers, there will be non-commissioned, and there will be other people, you know. And this was the first introduction of the rank system. Lots of us were very upset about this because it meant that we didn't get the same kind of food that they got. They sometimes got better than us. We were finished up with pimiento and chickpea, and you know, they got the rice sort of thing, you know. But from here, we started preparations for the Battle of Brunete. In the meantime, I had been sent back to Albacete to do some work for Frank Ryan, who was compiling the 15th Brigade book, which was compiling all letters, articles, appreciations and so on, photographs. I don't know whether you've seen the 15th book. I'll let you see it afterwards and then you can see what we're talking about. I haven't got the original copy, but Frank Graham, who was a publisher in the north of England, he published a copy of it some years ago. I lost my original copy when I was in Scotland in the British Army. Met some members of the Communist Party and they begged me to let them have it just for an hour. And that was it. I never saw it again. But we were now preparing for the Battle of Brunete. I went back to Albacete, was doing some work down there. That's when I first met George Brown. He had come out and been in hospital, caught a chill or something, had been in hospital and was on his way back up to join the battalion. And he sorted me out and he gave me a copy of a revolutionary songbook which had been signed by all the Manchester men in, still alive in the brigade. And he asked me to take care of it. Stupidly enough, I lent it to somebody one day, just to copy one song out. I lent it to Frank Ryan, who gave it to his Polish friend, and that was that. You know, I never saw it again, so I lost that particular memento. But George went into the battalion as a company commissar. I'm still with the truck, with the propaganda truck, and I'm in a convoy of which Doc Sullenberger has got an ambulance, and he is just in front of me, and Villanueva has been captured. I've watched the attack on Villanueva de la Cañada, and then we go through the village and we're moving on to their next place, and as we're going through the village, my